The radical Islamist movement has never had a clear idea of governing, or even much interest in it, as the Taliban would conclusively demonstrate. Purification was the goal, and whenever purity is paramount, terror is close at hand. Bin Laden cited American support for Israel as the first cause of his declaration of war, followed by the presence of American troops in Arabia. He added that American civilians must also leave the Islamic Holy Land because he could not guarantee their safety. In the most revealing exchange, Arnett asked whether, if the United States complied with bin Laden's demands to leave Arabia, he would call off his jihad. The reaction came as a result of the aggressive U.S. policy toward the entire Muslim world, not just the Arabian Peninsula, bin Laden said. Therefore, the United States has to withdraw from any kind of intervention against Muslims in the whole world. Bin Laden was already speaking as the representative of the Islamic nation, a caliph in waiting. The U.S. today has set a double standard, calling whoever goes against this injustice a terrorist, he complained. It wants to occupy our countries, steal our resources, impose on us agents to rule us, and wants us to agree to all these. If we refuse to do so, it will say, you are terrorists. This time, Mullah Omar sent a helicopter to Jalalabad and summoned bin Laden to Kandahar. It wasn't clear whether bin Laden would prove to be an ally or a rival. In either case, Omar couldn't afford to leave him in Jalalabad, on the opposite side of the country, in an area that the Taliban only marginally controlled. The talkative Saudi obviously had to be restrained or expelled. The two men met at the Kandahar airport. Omar told bin Laden that the Taliban intelligence service claimed to have uncovered a plot by some tribal mercenaries to kidnap him. Whether or not the story was true, it provided the excuse for Mullah Omar to order bin Laden to evacuate his people from Jalalabad and relocate to Kandahar, where the Taliban could keep an eye on him. Omar personally extended his protection to bin Laden, but he said that the interviews must come to a stop. Bin Laden said he had already decided to freeze his media campaign. 3 days later, bin Laden flew all of his family members and supporters to Kandahar, and he followed by car. Once again, his entire movement had been uprooted. Once again, discouraged followers drifted away. Omar gave bin Laden and al-Qaeda the choice of occupying a housing complex built for the workers of the electric company, which had all the necessary utilities, or an abandoned agricultural compound called Tarnak Farms, which had none, not even running water. Bin Laden chose the dilapidated farm. "We want a simple life," he said. Behind the 10-foot walls of the compound were about 80 mud brick or concrete structures, including dormitories, a small mosque, storage facilities, and a crumbling 6-story office building. Bin Laden's 3 wives were all crowded into a walled compound where they lived, according to one of bin Laden's bodyguards, in perfect harmony. Outside the walls, the Taliban stationed 2 T-55 Soviet tanks. As always, bin Laden drew strength from privation and seemed oblivious to the toll such circumstances took on others. When a Yemeni jihadi, Abu Jandal, went to his chief complaining that there was nothing for the men to eat, bin Laden replied, "My son, Jandal, we have not yet reached a condition like that of the Prophet's companions, who placed stones against their middles and tightened them around their waists. The Messenger of Allah used 2 stones." "Those men were strong in faith, and God wished to test them," Abu Jandal protested. "We, on the other hand, have sinned, and God would not test us." Bin Laden laughed. Meals were often little more than stale bread and well water. Bin Laden would dip the hard bread in the water and say, "May God be praised, we are eating, but there are millions of others who wish that they could have something like this to eat." There was little money to buy provisions. One of the Arabs came to bin Laden asking for funds for an emergency trip abroad. Bin Laden went into the house, collected all the cash he could find, and emerged with about $100. Realizing that bin Laden was emptying the treasury, Abu Jandal complained, Why did you not leave a part of that money for us? Those who are staying here are more deserving than those who are leaving. Bin Laden replied, Do not worry. Our livelihood will come to us. But for the next 5 days there was nothing to eat in the camp except the green pomegranates that grew around Bin Laden's house. We ate raw pomegranates with bread 3 times a day, Abu Jandal recalled. After Zawafri left Sudan in 1996, he became a phantom. Egyptian intelligence agents tracked him to Switzerland and Sarajevo. He allegedly sought asylum in Bulgaria, but an Egyptian newspaper also reported that he was living luxuriously in a Swiss villa near the French border, and that he had $30 million in a secret account. At the same time, Zawafri nominally edited the Al-Jihad newspaper, Al-Mujahideen, which had its office in Copenhagen. Neither Swiss nor Danish intelligence knows whether Zawahiri was ever actually in either country during this time. A fake passport he was using shows that he traveled to Malaysia, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong. He was reported to have been in Holland talking about establishing a satellite television channel. He said he was backed by wealthy Arabs who wanted to provide a fundamentalist alternative to the Al Jazeera network recently launched in Qatar. Zawafri's plan was to broadcast 10 hours a day to Europe and the Middle East, using only male presenters, but he never pursued it. Zawafri also traveled to Chechnya, where he hoped to establish a new home base for Al-Jihad. Conditions there were excellent, he wrote in a memo to his colleagues. The Russians had begun to withdraw from Chechnya earlier that year, after achieving a ceasefire with the rebellious, largely Muslim region. To the Islamists, Chechnya offered an opportunity to create an Islamic Republic in the Caucasus, from which they could wage jihad throughout Central Asia. If the Chechens and other Caucasian mujahideen reached the shores of the oil-rich Caspian Sea, the only thing that will separate them from Afghanistan will be the neutral state of Turkmenistan, Zawafri observed in his memoir. This will form a Mujahid Islamic belt to the south of Russia that will be connected in the east to Pakistan, which is brimming with Mujahideen movements in Kashmir. Thus the caliphate would begin to recreate itself. The world he was making seemed very much at hand. At 4 in the morning on December 1, 1996, Zawafri crossed into Russia in a minivan with two of his closest assistants, Mahmoud Hisham al-Hanawi and Ahmed Salama Mabruk, who was head of the Al-Jihad cell in Azerbaijan. Traveling without visas, they were detained at a roadblock and taken to the Federal Security Service, which charged them with entering the country illegally. Zawafri carried 4 passports, each from a different country and with a different name. The Russians were never able to establish his real identity. They found $6,400 in cash, some other forged documents, including graduation certificates for Mr. Amin from the Medical School of Cairo University, a number of medical textbooks, and a laptop, fax, and satellite phone. At the trial, Zawahiri posed as a Sudanese merchant. He claimed he was unaware that he had crossed the border illegally, and maintained that he had come to Russia to find out the price for leather, medicine, and other goods. The judge sentenced Zawafri and his companions to 6 months in jail. They had nearly completed the term by the time of the trial, and a few weeks later they were taken to the border of Azerbaijan and sent on their way. God blinded them to our identities, Zawafri boasted in an account of his trip to his disgruntled supporters, who had wondered where he was. This fiasco had a profound consequence. With even more defectors from his membership and no real sources of income, Zawahiri had no choice but to join bin Laden in Kandahar. Each man saw an advantage in linking forces. Al-Qaeda and Al-Jihad were both very much reduced from their salad days in Sudan. However, the Pakistani intelligence service had persuaded the Taliban to return the Al-Qaeda camps in Khost and elsewhere to bin Laden's control in order to train militants to fight in Kashmir. With ISI subsidizing the cost, the training camps had become an important source of revenue. Moreover, bin Laden was still able to call upon a few of his donors from the days of the Soviet jihad. So at least there was a modest income, enough for bin Laden to be able to purchase some expensive vehicles for Mullah Omar and his top commanders, which made him more welcome. Despite the still dire financial circumstances, Zawahiri believed that his fortunes were better served with bin Laden than without him. Many of the Egyptians regrouped in Afghanistan, including Abu Hafs, who was appointed the al-Qaeda military chief after Abu Ubaida's drowning. Al-Qaeda was able to provide only $100 per month stipend, half of what it had paid in Sudan. The leaders of the Islamic group came, and some other Islamists from Pakistan and Bangladesh. At first they gathered in Jalalabad in the same compound with the al-Qaeda families, about 250 people altogether, and most of them followed bin Laden when he moved to Kandahar. They were dismayed by the squalor, the awful food, the noxious water, and especially the lack of facilities. Hepatitis and malaria were epidemic. "This place is worse than a tomb," one of the Egyptians wrote home. Eventually their leader, Zawahiri, joined them. Since there was no more schooling in Afghanistan, the children spent a lot of time with each other. Zainab Ahmed Qadr, a Canadian citizen and the strong-willed daughter of one of Zawahiri's prominent supporters, was upset when her family left Peshawar, where they had lived comfortably for 15 of her 18 years. Afghanistan was just across the steep ridge of mountains that blocked the sunset, and yet it seemed anchored in another century. Although she already covered herself completely, even wearing gloves and a niqab over her face, she detested the burqa, which Afghan women were forced to wear. Her parents promised that she would be happy in this country, where the true Islam was being practiced, and that she would soon find new friends to replace the schoolmates she'd grown up with. Zainab moodily declared that she didn't want to make any friends. 2 days later, her mother said they were going to meet the bin Ladens. "I don't want to meet anybody," she said defiantly. "If you don't behave yourself, you'll never dream of going to Peshawar again," her father said impatiently. As it turned out, bin Laden's daughters became some of Zainab's closest friends. Fatima, the oldest, who was 14 in 1997, was the daughter of Abdullah, and Khadija, 13, was the daughter of Khalid. Fatima was the name of one of the Prophet's daughters, and Khadija was the name of his first wife. The age difference between Zainab and the bin Laden girls was something she simply accepted, since they were living in such a small community. Bin Laden's three wives and their children lived in separate houses inside their compound. All the children of Al-Qaeda were dressed in rags, and the effort to keep even minimal levels of cleanliness often came to naught. Zainab observed that each of the bin Laden houses was clean and distinctly different. Abdullah was poorly educated, but fun and good-hearted, and she loved to decorate. Whereas the houses of the other wives were neat and well-scrubbed, hers was also beautiful. There were flowers and posters and coloring books for the younger children. Her daughter Fatima had to do a lot of cleaning, Zainab noticed, because the mother was not raised to work. Fatima was fun, but a little slow. She confided to Zainab that she would never marry any of the men around her father because he'd be wanted everywhere in the world. "His crime would be marrying you, Fatima," Zainab said. "Oh, right." Zainab was not joking. In the world the girls lived in, marriage was a union of families, not just individuals. It seemed to Zainab that Fatima had forgotten who she was. Of course, Fatima had no say about whom she would marry. Her eventual husband, one of bin Laden's followers, would be killed 4 years later in the evacuation of Kandahar. Life was very different in Khalid's house, quieter and more organized. Unlike Abdullah, Khalid made an attempt to educate her three daughters and one son. A private school for the Arab boys started up in the compound, but the girls studied at home. Khalid, who had a doctorate in the subject, helped Zainab study Arabic grammar. and she often pitched in with the girls to make dinner. Bin Laden taught his daughters math and science, spending time with them every day. Sometimes he would give them quizzes to make sure they were keeping up. Khalid's oldest daughter, Khadija, liked to read history and biography. Although in Zainab's opinion, none of the children were well-educated, she thought that Khadija was very, very bright. Hamza had only one child, a son, but in Zainab's opinion, compared to the other wives, Hamza was the greatest. She was also the oldest and 7 years older than her husband. Her eyesight was weak and her constitution frail. She suffered frequent miscarriages. As a Saudi woman from a wealthy and distinguished family, she exuded a regal quality, but she was deeply committed to the cause. When Bin Laden had proposed to her, Hamza's family was deeply offended because she would be his second wife, but she consented because she wanted to marry a true Mujahid. Hamza was very popular in the Al-Qaeda community. Other women felt that they could go to her, and she would talk to them as if their problems were important to her. "We knew things might collapse around us, and we'd get depressed," said Zainab. She'd keep everybody going. Bin Laden also depended on her. Although he tried to treat his wives equally, as the Quran commands, everyone knew that Hamza was his favorite. She was not beautiful, but she was sensible and devoted. Her house was always the neatest. There was a bed in the house and a box that contained all her clothes. She would have a shalwar kameez, the typical Afghan gown, on the back of the door, clean and ready for Bin Laden. In the bathroom, there was a small shelf with a bottle of perfume for her and one for her husband. Abdullah was extremely jealous of their relationship. Although she was first in the rank of wives and the mother of 11 of Bin Laden's children, she was also the youngest and least educated. Her beauty was her only advantage, and she worked hard to keep herself attractive. Whenever other women traveled, especially to Western countries, Abdullah gave them a shopping list of brand-name cosmetics and lingerie, preferring American products that no one else would consider buying. Bin Laden's wives all lived within a small inner court in the larger compound, and Abdullah would put on a jogging suit and run around the perimeter to keep in shape. She would always be fighting with Osama, her friend Maha Elsamna recalled. "I would tell her, this man could be taken away from you in the blink of an eye. You should enjoy him while he is with you. Don't make him so miserable every time he's around." The girls sometimes played childish pranks on each other. On one occasion, when Fatima didn't want Zainab to go home, she cajoled her younger sister, Iman, into hiding Zainab's shoes and her head covering until the curfew sounded, so she was stuck there all night. Bin Laden's children did not see him as being nearly as pious and intransigent as the rest of the community did. When Fatima wanted to borrow several cassette tapes, Zainab told her, "I'll give them to you on one condition. Your dad shouldn't hear them because some men are very strict." "My dad is not going to destroy them," Fatima protested. "He's not really that hard. He just acts like that in front of the men." "He actually listens to songs?" Zainab asked, amazed. "Oh, yeah, he doesn't mind." Reflecting his love of horses, Bin Laden kept a library of books on the subject in Khalid's house, and even tolerated coloring books and calendars with pictures of horses on them, although no one else in the community allowed pictures on the walls. Zainab concluded, "The sheikh was pretty broad-minded." The older Bin Laden boys were usually with their father nearby in Tora Bora. Among the teenagers, there was a strange, unstable mix of boredom and mortal danger. Unlike the girls, the boys had the opportunity to go to school, but they did little other than memorize the Quran all day. Bin Laden let his younger sons play Nintendo because there was not much else to entertain them. The boys were quite wild and inclined to reckless behavior to escape the monotony. One of Zainab's younger brothers, Abdulrahman, became friends with Bin Laden's son by the same name. They were the only two boys in the compound whose fathers could afford a horse for them. Sometimes, instead of riding, they would goad their animals into fighting each other. Abdulrahman Bin Laden's horse was a spirited Arabian, But when Abdulrahman Khadr brought a stronger horse that nearly killed the Arabian, the bin Laden boy chambered a bullet in his gun and pointed it at Khadr, saying he would shoot him if he didn't pull his horse off. Murder and mayhem were always brewing. In the afternoons, the boys often played volleyball, and Osama would sometimes join in the game. He was apparently in excellent health. Once, he bought a horse from the Taliban, who said they had captured it from Ahmed Shah Massoud. It was a large golden stallion with three white stockings. Nobody could ride it until bin Laden jumped on his back and galloped off. 25 minutes later, he rode back into the compound with the horse completely under his control. The men who were so feared and despised in the rest of the world did not seem so terrifying in their own homes, where they roughhoused with the children and helped with their homework. Zainab remembered one occasion when her family was at the Zawafri's house in Kandahar, and the father came in carrying his machine gun. As he was going up the stairs, Zainab's 10-year-old brother grabbed Zawafri's legs and begged him to give it to him. "Abdul Karim, just wait until we go to the room," said Zawafri. The boy wouldn't let go. He kept begging and grabbing for the weapon. Zawafri finally relented and let the boy examine his weapon. This struck Zainab and the others as a tender moment. "And this is the man they make him seem like a monster," she exclaimed. The four Zawafri daughters were bright, outspoken, and beautiful, particularly Nabila. When she turned 12, she became a subject of intense interest among the bride-shopping mothers in the community. Muhammad, the Zawahiri's only son, was also very attractive, the pet of his older sisters. As he got older, however, he was spending more time with the men and with his classmates. It was a rough environment for such a delicate, well-mannered boy, and he was constantly teased and bullied. He preferred to stay at home and help his mother. The Zawafri girls would often get together for games or exercise. Aza, their mother, liked to have small parties, although there was little to offer her guests, sometimes no more than noodles and tomatoes. When Zainab visited the Zawafris for the engagement of their second daughter, Umayma, the girls talked and talked through breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Late at night, they were still singing, making so much noise that they couldn't hear Dr. Ayman knocking on the door, asking them to keep it down. "I thought about how this guy scares the whole world, but he doesn't even scream at us. We see them as nice and gentle." Despite her modest manner, Zawafri's wife insisted on retaining a certain elegance. Aza sewed her own clothes, preferring classical styles. She obtained some patterns from Iran, and she taught herself enough Persian to understand the instructions. She also sewed nightgowns to raise money, usually donating a portion of her income to various needful projects. She and the girls made floral strands out of candy wrappers and strung them on the wall, and arranged stones in a pleasing design in front of their humble mud cottage. In 1997, Aza had a surprise. She was pregnant again, almost a decade after the birth of her last child. The baby was born in the winter, severely underweight. Dr. Ayman realized at once that his fifth daughter suffered from Down syndrome. Aza, already pressed by the responsibility of taking care of a large family in extraordinary circumstances, accepted this new burden as well. They named the baby Aisha. Everyone loved her, but Aza was the only one who could attend to all her needs. Looking back at her friendships with the bin Laden and the Zawafri children, Zainab observed that the families had their ups and downs, but they were pretty much normal kids. They had pretty much a normal childhood. In July 1997, 2 months after Zawafri returned to Afghanistan, he was infuriated by a development in Egypt that threatened to undermine his entire movement. The Islamist lawyer Muntasir al-Sayyad had brokered a deal between the Islamic group and the Egyptian government. The Non-Violence Initiative, as it was called, had originated in the same prisons where Zayat and Zawafri had been incarcerated together 16 years before. With 20,000 Islamists in Egyptian custody, and thousands of others who had been cut down by the security forces, the fundamentalist movement had been paralyzed, and it was clear to the leaders of the Islamic group that unless they formally renounced violence, they would never see daylight. After the initiative was declared, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman added his imprimatur from his prison cell in the United States. While denying that a deal had been struck, the government released 2,000 members of the Islamic group within the following year. Many senior members of Sawafri's own al-Jihad joined the movement to reconcile with the regime. At first, Sawafri was alone in his dissent. "The political translation of this initiative is surrender," he raged. "In which battle is a fighter forced to end his fighting and incitement, accept captivity, and turn in his men and weapons in exchange for nothing?" The barrage of letters over this matter between Sawafri and other Islamists to the editor of an Arabic paper in London came to be called the War of the Faxes. Sawafri said he understood the suffering of the imprisoned leaders, but if we are going to stop now, why did we start in the first place? Zawafri's stance divided the Egyptian Islamists between those still in the country who wanted peace and those outside Egypt who opposed reconciliation. Zawafri enlisted Mustafa Hamza, the new emir of the rival Islamic group, and its military leader, Rifai Ahmed Taha, both of whom were in Afghanistan, to join him. As for the blind sheikh's participation in the initiative, he may have thought of it as a bargaining chip with the Americans, who he hoped would set him free. When it later became clear that would not happen, he retracted his support. The Egyptian exiles decided to justify the continuing use of violence through a single transformative blow. The attack may have been intended for a performance of Aida, Verdi's opera of ancient Egypt, which was staged in October 1997. In front of Queen Hatshepsut's temple on the west bank of the Nile near Luxor. The splendid ruin is one of the great artifacts of the new kingdom. Suzanne Mubarak, the president's wife, hosted the opening night gala. The Islamic group's strategy was to attack tourism, the life force of the Egyptian economy and the main source of foreign exchange, in order to provoke the government into repressive, unpopular responses. Al-Jihad had always disdained this approach as counterproductive, but with so many VIPs and government officials in attendance, including the president himself, the performance also presented the opportunity to accomplish Al-Jihad's goal of decapitating the government. The presence of 3,000 security officers initially deterred this attack, however. On November 17, 1997, the glorious ruin looked out on the amber sand of the southern desert as it had for 35 centuries, long before Jesus or Muhammad or even Abraham, the father of the great monotheistic religions. The summer heat had ebbed, marking the beginning of the high season, and hundreds of tourists were strolling through the grounds, some in groups with Egyptian guides, others snapping photos and shopping in the kiosks. Six young men, dressed in black police uniforms and carrying vinyl bags, entered the temple precinct shortly before 9 a.m. One of the men shot a guard, and then they all put on red headbands, identifying themselves as members of the Islamic group. Two of the attackers remained at the gate to await the shootout with the police, who never arrived. The other men crisscrossed the terraced temple grounds, mowing down tourists by shooting their legs, then methodically finishing them off with close shots to the head. They paused to mutilate some of the bodies with butcher knives. One elderly Japanese man was eviscerated. A pamphlet was later found stuffed in his body that said, "No to tourists in Egypt." It was signed Omar Abdulrahman's Squadron of Havoc and Destruction, the Gama Islamiyah, the Islamic group. Caught inside the temple, cowering behind the limestone colonnades, the tourists tried to hide, but there was no escape. It was a perfect trap. The screams of the victims were echoed by cries of Allahu Akbar as the attackers reloaded. The killing went on for 45 minutes, until the floors streamed with blood. The dead included a 5-year-old British child and 4 Japanese couples on their honeymoons. The ornamented walls were splattered with brains and bits of hair. When the job was done, the attackers hijacked a bus, looking for more tourists to kill, but at last they ran into a police checkpoint In the shootout that followed, one of the attackers was wounded. His companions killed him, then fled into the hills, chased by tour guides and villagers on scooters and donkeys, who had little more to fight with than shovels and stones. The attackers' bodies were later found in a cave, arranged in a circle. The Egyptian press speculated that they had been murdered by the outraged village posse, but they apparently killed themselves in a ritualistic suicide. One of the men had a note in his pocket, apologizing for not carrying out the operation sooner. 58 tourists and 4 Egyptians had died, not counting the attackers. It was the worst act of terror in modern Egyptian history. The majority of the victims, 35 of them, were Swiss. Others came from Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, France, Bulgaria, and Colombia. 17 other tourists and 9 Egyptians were wounded. One Swiss woman had seen her father's head cut off in front of her eyes. The following day, the Islamic group claimed credit for the attack. Rifai Taha said that the attackers were supposed to take hostages in order to free the imprisoned Islamist leaders, but the systematic slaughter put the lie to that claim. The death of the killers showed the influence of Zawahiri. Until this point, the Islamic group had never engaged in suicide operations. The Swiss federal police later determined that bin Laden had financed the operation. Egypt was in shock. Revolted and ashamed, the population decisively turned against the Islamists, who suddenly began issuing retractions and pointing fingers in the usual directions. From prison, the blind sheikh blamed the Israelis, saying that Mossad had carried out the massacre. Zawahiri blamed the Egyptian police, who he said had done the actual killing, but he also held the victims responsible for coming to the country. The people of Egypt considered the presence of these foreign tourists to be aggression against Muslims in Egypt, he said. The young men are saying that this is our country and not a place for frolicking and enjoyment, especially for you. Luxor proved to be the turning point in the counter-terrorist campaign in Egypt. Whatever the strategists in Afghanistan had thought would come of their one great blow, the consequences had landed on them, not on their adversaries. Their support evaporated, and without the consent of the population, there was nowhere for them to hide. In the 5 years before Luxor, Islamist terror groups in Egypt had killed more than 1,200 people, many of them foreigners. After Luxor, the attacks by the Islamists simply stopped. We thought we'd never hear from them again, one Cairo human rights worker observed. Perhaps, in their isolation in Kandahar, the jihadi leaders, especially the Egyptians, could not appreciate the nature of their defeat. They were locked into a logic of their own making. They spoke mainly to each other, fortifying their opinions with selected verses from the Quran and lessons from Hadith that made their destiny appear inescapable. They lived in a country so brutalized by endless violence that the horror of Luxor could not have seemed all that significant. Indeed, the Taliban revolution had inspired them to become even bloodier and more intransigent. And yet, immediately after Luxor, there was a period of introspection among the leaders, who analyzed their predicament and prescribed a strategy for the triumph of Islam and the final showdown with the unbelievers. The main point of their diagnosis was that the Islamic nation was in misery because of illegitimate leadership. The jihadis then asked themselves who was responsible for this situation. They pointed to what they called the Christian-Jewish alliance that had emerged following the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement, in which Britain and France divided Arab lands between them, and the Balfour Declaration the following year, which called for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Soon thereafter, the Ottoman Empire collapsed, and with it, the Islamic Caliphate. This was all seen as an ongoing campaign by the Christian-Jewish alliance to suffocate Islam, using such tools as the United Nations, compliant Arab rulers, multinational corporations, satellite channels, and international relief agencies. Radical Islamist groups had risen in the past, only to fail because of disunity and the lack of a clear plan. In January 1998, Zawahiri began writing a draft of a formal declaration that would unite all of the different Mujahideen groups that had gathered in Afghanistan under a single banner. It would turn the movement away from regional conflicts and toward a global Islamic jihad against America. The language was measured and concise in comparison with bin Laden's declaration of war 2 years before. Sawafri cited three grievances against the Americans. First, the continuing presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia 7 years after the end of the Gulf War. If some people have formally debated the fact of the occupation, all the people of the peninsula have now acknowledged it, he observed. Second, America's intention to destroy Iraq, as evidenced by the death of what he said was more than 1 million civilians. Third, the American goal of propping up Israel by incapacitating the Arab states, whose weakness and disunion are Israel's only guarantee of survival. All this amounted to a war on God, his messenger, and the Muslims. Therefore, the members of the coalition were issuing a fatwa. The ruling to kill the Americans and their allies, civilian and military, is an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it. On February 23rd, Al-Quds al-Arabi in London published the text of the fatwa by the new coalition, which called itself the International Islamic Front for Jihad Against Jews and Crusaders. It was signed by bin Laden individually, Sawahri as leader of al-Jihad, Rifai Taha as leader of the Islamic group, the Pakistani opposition figures Sheikh Mir Hamza, secretary of the Jamiat al-Ulama, and Fazlul Rahman, head of Harakat al-Ansar, and Sheikh Abdulsalam Muhammad Khan, the leader of the Bangladeshi group Harakat al-Jihad. The name Al-Qaeda was not used. Its existence was still a closely held secret. Outside of Afghanistan, members of the Islamic group greeted the declaration with disbelief. After the catastrophe of Luxor, they were appalled to find themselves part of a coalition that they hadn't been asked to join. Taha was forced to withdraw his name from the fatwa, lamely explaining to fellow members of the Islamic group that he had only been asked over the telephone to join in a statement of support for the Iraqi people. Al-Jihad was also in an uproar. Zawahri called a meeting of his supporters in Afghanistan to explain the new global organization. The members accused him of turning away from their primary goal of taking over Egypt, and they protested al-Jihad's being drawn into bin Laden's grandiose war with America. Some objected to bin Laden personally, saying he had a dark past and could not be trusted as the head of this new coalition. Zawahri responded to the attacks on bin Laden by email. If the contractor, bin Laden, made promises in the past he did not carry out, then now the man has changed. Even at this time, almost everything we enjoy comes to us from God first and then from him. His attachment to bin Laden by now was total. Without bin Laden's money, however scarce it had become, there was no al-Jihad. In the end, Zawahri pledged to resign if the members failed to endorse his actions. The organization was in such disarray because of arrests and defections, and so close to bankruptcy that the only choice was to follow Zawahri or abandon al-Jihad. Many members chose the latter option, among them Zawahri's own brother Muhammad, who was also his military commander. The two brothers had been together from their underground days. They had sometimes been at odds with each other. On one occasion, Ayman denounced Muhammad in front of his colleagues for mismanaging the group's paltry finances. But Muhammad was popular. And as deputy emir, he had run the organization whenever Ayman was off on his lengthy travels or in jail. The alliance with bin Laden was too much for Muhammad, however. His defection was a shocking blow. Several members of the Islamic group tried to have the blind sheikh named emir of the new Islamic front, but the proposal was brushed aside since Sheikh Omar was in prison in America. Bin Laden had had enough of the infighting between the Egyptian factions. He told both groups that their operations in Egypt were ineffectual and too expensive, and that it was time for them to turn their guns on the United States and Israel. Zawahri's assistant, Ahmed al-Najjar, later told Egyptian investigators, "I myself heard bin Laden say that our main objective is now limited to one state only, the United States, and involves waging a guerrilla war against all U.S. interests, not only in the Arab region, but also throughout the world. Chapter 16. Now it begins. Al-Qaeda's fortunes began to improve after the coalition's fatwa to kill Americans wherever they might be found. Until then, bin Laden's name and his cause had been obscure outside of Saudi Arabia and Sudan. But news of the fatwa excited a new generation of fighters. Some came from the madrasas in Pakistan, others from the streets of Cairo or Tangier. The call was heard also in Muslim enclaves in the West. In March 1998, only a month after the fatwa, Ahmed Rassam came from Montreal, a petty thief of Algerian origin who would later be arrested for trying to blow up the Los Angeles International Airport. Rassam was one of about 30 Algerians in the Khaldan camp, the entry point for Al-Qaeda trainees in Afghanistan. That same month, Zacharias Moussaoui, a French citizen of Moroccan descent who was living in London, arrived. He would later plead guilty to planning to attack the United States. Young men from Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Sweden, Turkey, and Chechnya came to Khaldan, and each nationality had its own emir. They created cells that they could then transplant to their own or adopted countries. Some went to fight in Kashmir and Chechnya. Many fought for the Taliban. Publicity was the currency bin Laden was spending, replacing his wealth with fame. And it repaid him with recruits and donations. Despite his pledge to Mullah Omar to remain silent, bin Laden followed up the fatwa with a series of press conferences and interviews, first with a group of 14 Pakistani journalists, who were driven around in circles for 2 days before landing in an Al-Qaeda camp only miles from where they had started. They stood around idly waiting for bin Laden to make his appearance. Suddenly, there was a barrage of gunfire and rocket grenades to herald bin Laden's arrival in a convoy of 4 pickup trucks, accompanied by bodyguards with their faces covered. A dog ran amok, looking for cover, and skidded behind a tree. The event struck the Pakistani reporters as staged and cartoonish. They weren't interested in bin Laden's declaration of war against America, which seemed like an absurd publicity stunt. India had just tested a nuclear device, and they wanted bin Laden to declare jihad against India instead. Frustrated, bin Laden tried to steer the reporters back to his agenda. "Let's talk about real problems," he pleaded. "Terrorism can be commendable, and it can be reprehensible," bin Laden philosophized in response to a planted question from one of his followers. "Terrifying an innocent person and terrorizing him is objectionable and unjust. Also, unjustly terrorizing people is not right, whereas terrorizing oppressors and criminals and thieves and robbers is necessary for the safety of people and for the protection of their property. The terrorism we practice is of the commendable kind." After the formal interview, Rahimullah Yousafzai, the reporter for the news in Islamabad, drew bin Laden aside and asked if he would talk a bit about his life. For instance, how many wives and children did he have? "I've lost count," bin Laden said, laughing. "Maybe at least you know about your wives," Yousafzai suggested. "I think I have 3 wives, but I have lost count of my children," bin Laden said. Yousafzai then asked bin Laden how much money he had. Bin Laden put his hand on his heart and smiled. "I am rich here," he said. He continued to evade personal questions. As soon as Yousafzai got back to Peshawar, he received a call from a furious Mullah Omar. "Bin Laden holds a press conference announcing jihad and he doesn't even tell me?" he exclaimed. "There can only be one ruler in Afghanistan, either me or bin Laden." These interviews always took a toll on bin Laden's voice, although he drank copious amounts of tea and water. The next day, he wouldn't speak at all, communicating by gesture, because his vocal cords were so inflamed. His bodyguard contended that this was the lingering effect of a Soviet chemical weapon, but some of the reporters concluded that he must be suffering from kidney disease, the origin of a persistent an unsubstantiated legend. 2 days after speaking to the Pakistani press, bin Laden received reporter John Miller and an ABC news crew. Beforehand, the irrepressible American correspondent had sat on the floor of a hut with Zawahiri and explained the needs of his crew. "Doc, we need shots of bin Laden going around the camps, interacting with the men, watching them train or whatever, so we'll have some footage over which we can narrate his story," Miller said. Zawahiri nodded knowingly. "You need some B-roll," he said, using the technical term for such coverage. He chuckled and continued, "Mr. Miller, you have to understand that this is not like your Sam Donaldson walking with the president in the Rose Garden. Mr. bin Laden is a very important man." It occurred to Miller at the time that Zawahiri might be the real power behind al-Qaeda. But then bin Laden himself arrived with the same staged, awe-inspiring fusillade as before. Over the chirping of crickets outside the mud hut, Miller asked bin Laden if his fatwa was directed at all Americans or just the military. Through history, America has not been known to differentiate between the military and the civilians, or between men and women, or adults and children, bin Laden quietly responded. He casts shy, doe-eyed glances at the American, as if he worried about giving offense. "We anticipate a black future for America. Instead of remaining United States, it shall end up separated states, just like the old Soviet Union." Bin Laden wore a white turban and a green military jacket. Looming behind his head was a large map of Africa, an unremarked clue. "You are like the Middle East version of Teddy Roosevelt," Miller concluded. During the interview, many of bin Laden's followers crowded into the hut. Two Saudis, Muhammad al-Awali and Jihad Ali Azam, were preparing for al-Qaeda's first big operation the following month. After Miller's crew finished the taping, bin Laden's technical experts erased the Saudis' faces from the videotape before giving it to the Americans. During the interview, Miller asked about Wali Khan Amin Shah, who had been arrested in Manila. "American authorities believe he was working for you, funded by you, setting up training camps there, and part of this plan was the assassination or the attempted assassination of President Clinton during his trip to Manila," said Miller. "Wali Khan was a close friend," bin Laden mildly replied. "As to what you said about him working for me, I have nothing to say. We are all together in this." The fact that Khan was in American custody was supposed to be a closely held secret, but someone had leaked that information to Miller. Some people in the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office were enraged when Khan's name was mentioned directly to bin Laden on television. They knew that John O'Neill was a friend of Christopher Isham, an investigative producer for ABC News. They often drank together at Elaine's. Patrick Fitzgerald, the assistant prosecutor in New York's Southern District, was so angry that he threatened to indict O'Neill. Both Isham and Miller denied that O'Neill was their source and volunteered to take lie detector tests to prove it. Fitzgerald backed off, but the allegation that O'Neill talked carelessly to reporters lingered as a slur on his reputation. It didn't help that some journalists' investigations of bin Laden were more creative than those of the American intelligence community. The fact was that the CIA had no one inside al-Qaeda or the Taliban security that surrounded bin Laden. The agency did have some contacts with a few Afghan tribesmen, leftover assets from the jihad against the Soviets. At Alex Station, Mike Scheuer came up with a plan to use them to kidnap bin Laden. The Afghans were supposed to enter through a drainage ditch that ran under the back fence of Tarnak Farms. Another group of Afghans would sneak through the front gate, using silenced pistols to kill whoever got in the way. When they found bin Laden, they would stash him in a cave 30 miles away. If they were caught, there would be no American fingerprints on the abduction. If they were not, then the Afghans would turn bin Laden over to the Americans a month or so later, after the search parties had given up. The CIA had outfitted what appeared to be a commercial shipping container that would fit in the cargo hull of a civilian version of a C-130 aircraft. Inside the container was a dentist chair with restraints modeled for a very tall man. The CIA was under the impression that bin Laden was 6 feet 5 inches tall. There would be a doctor inside the box as well, and he would have a wide array of medical equipment available to him, including a dialysis machine in case bin Laden actually did have kidney problems. The agency had even built a landing strip on a private ranch near El Paso, Texas, in order to practice landing at night with no lights, the pilots using night vision goggles. It was Scheuer's plan to drop bin Laden in Egypt, where he could be rudely questioned and then quietly disposed of. John O'Neill furiously objected to this idea. He was a lawman, not a killer. He wanted bin Laden arrested and tried in America. He made his case to Janet Reno, the U.S. Attorney General, who agreed to let the Bureau take possession of bin Laden should he actually be captured. Soon Dan Coleman found himself in El Paso, rehearsing his role as the arresting officer. The plane would land, the cargo door would open, and then the container with the manacled terrorist inside would be loaded into the bay. Coleman would enter the container and find Osama bin Laden strapped to the dentist chair. Then he would read him his rights. But for that, he needed an indictment. A federal grand jury in New York was listening to evidence, even as the training was underway. One of the documents Coleman found on Wadi al-Hajj's computer in Nairobi made a tentative link between al-Qaeda and the killing of American servicemen in Somalia, and that became the basis of the criminal indictment that was eventually returned against bin Laden in New York in June 1998. Those specific charges against him were later dropped, however, and no testimony in subsequent terrorist trials ever proved that al-Qaeda or bin Laden had been responsible for the murder of Americans or anyone else before August of that year. Had he been captured at that time, it's unlikely that bin Laden would have been convicted. The dispute between the FBI's O'Neill and the CIA's Scheuer, along with the reluctance of the National Security Council to endorse what might be an embarrassing and bloody fiasco, paralyzed the plan. In desperation, George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, flew to the kingdom twice in May 1998 to beg for the help of the Saudis. According to Scheuer, Crown Prince Abdullah made it clear that if the Saudis succeeded in getting bin Laden from the Taliban, American intelligence would never breathe a word. The Saudis had their own concerns about bin Laden. Prince Turki had learned that he had attempted to smuggle weapons to his followers inside the kingdom in order to attack police stations. The Saudis repeatedly complained to the Taliban about bin Laden's meddling with Saudi internal affairs, to no effect. Finally, in June 1998, the king summoned Turkey and told him, "Finish this." Turkey flew into the Kandahar airport directly over the fortress-like Tarnak Farms. Until then, Turkey had never met Mullah Omar. The prince was taken to a decrepit guest house, the former home of a wealthy merchant, a remnant of what had once been a graceful city. Mullah Omar limped forward to greet him. The one-eyed leader appeared thin and pale, with a long beard and some kind of infirmity in one of his hands, which he clutched to his chest. War wounds and other afflictions were surpassingly common in Afghanistan. Most of the Taliban cabinet members and governors were amputees or severely handicapped in multiple ways, and it was rare for any male assemblage to have a full complement of arms, legs, or eyes. Turkey shook hands and sat opposite him on the floor of the salon. Behind Omar were French doors that looked out onto a semicircular terrace, and beyond that to a dusty, barren yard. Even during such an important ceremonial occasion as this, there was a casually disconcerting atmosphere of chaos. The room was full of people, young and old, entering at their leisure. Turkey was grateful at least for the single air conditioner, which moderated the stifling heat of the Afghan summer. Turkey had brought with him Sheikh Abdullah Turkey, a renowned Islamic scholar and the former minister for religious endowments, which was a lucrative source of contributions to the Taliban. In addition to serving as a reminder of Saudi support, Sheikh Abdullah's authoritative presence would instantly resolve any religious or legal questions that might be posed about bin Laden's status, reminding Omar of his pledge to keep bin Laden from launching attacks of any kind against the kingdom. Turkey then asked Mullah Omar to hand over bin Laden, who had inconveniently left town for the duration of Turkey's visit. Mullah Omar professed to be totally surprised. "I can't just give him to you to put on the plane," Omar complained. "After all, we provided him shelter." Prince Turkey was stupefied by this turnabout. Mullah Omar then lectured him on the Pashto tribal code, which he said was quite strict about betraying guests. Sheikh Abdullah Turkey offered the opinion that if a guest breaks his word, as bin Laden had done repeatedly by granting press interviews, that action absolves the host who is protecting him. The Taliban leader was unconvinced. Thinking that Omar needed a face-saving compromise, Prince Turkey suggested that the two of them set up a committee that would explore ways to formally hand over bin Laden. Then Prince Turkey and his party got up to leave. As he did so, Turkey asked specifically, "Are you agreed in principle that you will give us bin Laden?" Mullah Omar said he was. After the meeting, Saudi Arabia reportedly sent 400 four-wheel drive pickup trucks and other financial aid to the Taliban as a down payment for bin Laden. 6 weeks later, the money and the trucks allowed the Taliban to retake Mazar-e-Sharif, a bastion of a Persian-speaking Shiite minority, the Hazaras. Among the Taliban fighters were several hundred Arabs sent by bin Laden. Well-placed bribes left a force of only 1,500 Hazara soldiers guarding the city, and they were quickly killed. Once inside the defenseless city, the Taliban continued raping and killing for 2 days, indiscriminately shooting anything that moved, then slitting throats and shooting dead men in the testicles. The bodies of the dead were left to wild dogs for 6 days before survivors were allowed to bury them. Those citizens who fled the city on foot were bombed by the Taliban Air Force. Hundreds of others were loaded into shipping containers and baked alive in the desert sun. The UN estimated the total number of victims in the slaughter to be between 5,000 and 6,000 people. They included 10 Iranian diplomats and a journalist, whom the Taliban rounded up and shot in the basement of the Iranian consulate. 400 women were taken to be concubines. But the massacre of Mazar was immediately overshadowed by other tragedies far away. After the formation of the Islamic Front, American intelligence agencies took a greater interest in Zawahiri and his organization, Al-Jihad, which was still separate from Al-Qaeda, but closely allied. In July 1998, CIA operatives kidnapped Ahmed Salama Mabruk and another member of Jihad outside a restaurant in Baku, Azerbaijan. Mabruk was Zawahiri's closest political confidant. The agents cloned his laptop computer, which contained Al-Qaeda organizational charts and a roster of Jihad members in Europe. The Rosetta Stone of Al-Qaeda, as Dan Coleman called it, but the CIA refused to turn it over to the FBI. It was a typical, pointless bureaucratic standoff of the sort that had handicapped counterterrorism efforts at both organizations from the start, made worse by the personal vindictiveness that several senior agency people, including Scheuer, felt toward O'Neill. Overvaluing information for its own sake, the agency was a black hole, emitting nothing that was not blasted out of it by a force greater than gravity. And it recognized that O'Neill was such a force. He would use the information for an indictment, a public trial, and it would no longer be secret, no longer be intelligence. It would be evidence. It would be news. And it would become useless as far as the agency was concerned. The agency treated the exposure of any bit of intelligence as a defeat. And it was in its nature to clutch the Mabruk computer as if it were the crown jewels. Such high-quality information was difficult to come by, and, when acquired, even more difficult to act upon. Because of decades of cutbacks on human intelligence assets, there were only 2,000 real operatives, spies, in the agency to cover the entire world.